So we look at Book of Esther, chapter 5, begin with verse 1. Hear now the word of the Lord. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the palace in front of the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the hall, facing the entrance. When he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her and held out to her the gold scepter that was in his hand. So Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. Then the king asked, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be given to you." "If it pleases the king," replied Esther, "let the king, together with Haman, come today to a banquet I have prepared for him." "Bring Haman at once," the king said, "so that we may do what Esther asks." So the king and Haman went to the banquet Esther had prepared. As they were drinking wine, the king again asked Esther, "Now what is your petition? It will be given you. And what is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted." Esther replied, "My petition and my request is this: if the king regards me with favor, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come tomorrow to the banquet I will prepare for them. Then I will answer the king's question." Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits. But when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, calling together his friends and Zeresh, his wife. Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways the king had honored him and how he had elevated him above the other nobles and officials. "And that's not all," Haman added. "I'm the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave. And she has invited me along with the king tomorrow. But all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate." His wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Have a pole set up reaching to a height of 50 cubits and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai impaled on it. Then go with the king to the banquet and enjoy yourself." This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the pole set up. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Today, it seems everybody is taking a stand for one thing or another, one issue or another. We're encouraged to get outraged and to be engaged. And so when an unsavory comment ever crosses our computer screens or our phones on social media, we feel the urge to make a speech, to correct an error, to tell the truth as we see it. From our social justice warriors to our conservative defenders of truth and tradition, many are choosing to take a stand. And that's not always a bad thing, except when taking a stand means that you stop listening to others. When you no longer have the ability to hear where someone else is coming from, when you stop up your ears and close off your hearts, then taking a stand may not be such a good thing. I've seen this many times, maybe in my own life, but also here in Big Rapids, that our way of taking a stand can just be shooting ourselves in the foot, and our cause too. You've told yourself no compromises, but somehow you must try to persuade and convince another human being that your way is best or makes the most sense. Your way of trying to force your way, coming into the room with guns blazing, taking no prisoners, pushing your cause, could actually mean suicide for your cause. And any chance of moving others toward your cause. We see and know many people who take a stand, and we applaud them and for their courage, for standing up for something, and something that's probably good. But the way they go about making their stand is often off-putting, annoying, irritating, rude, offensive. And so the people we try to persuade, teach, or try to move toward our position on an issue become immediately turned off, and they go on the defensive, and they'll even start arguing back with you, even if they don't care about the cause. All because of the way that you are approaching them or approaching the subject. And this goes for our approach to political issues, but even evangelism and sharing the truth of the gospel with others. So take your stand. Be engaged. By all means, do that. Advocate for your cause. Raise your awareness on whatever issue you want to raise awareness about. But how you do so just may impact the effectiveness of your efforts. And my two cents this morning, raising your voice, shouting, screaming, violence, destruction of personal property is not a good, effective way of gaining a good hearing or to engender others toward sympathy toward your cause. Getting attention by any means is not usually helpful in persuading others. Some of these tactics actually become a form of terrorism in our day, to move people by force or fear. We can and have learned a lot from Esther this summer, and this morning we can learn a lot from her about taking a stand with wisdom and winsomeness. Wisdom, of course, is not just having knowledge, but not just knowing the facts about something, but wisdom includes the ability to apply that knowledge to everyday life, applying truth to life. And I think discernment is part of that. Discernment is a type of wisdom where you can see beyond the facts and you can see how two things come together or don't come together, as the case may be. For example, you know your children. You know facts and details about them, their likes and dislikes. Wisdom and discernment tells you that given your knowledge about their age and their temperament and past experiences, that standing an hour in line at the fair is going to be a nightmare. So your wisdom and your discernment helps you make other plans ahead of time. Your discernment will also tell you that given what you know about the mayor's position about porta potties in the city, maybe he's against them, that you should approach the subject gently, slowly, and factually with him. That's just a fictional example. I don't know what the mayor actually believes here in Big Rapids about porta potties. But if you know that he's against them in the city, then maybe you want to be careful in how you approach him if you're trying to push for them. So emotional intelligence is just as important as cerebral intelligence and just the facts. We call it having tact, maybe, decorum, being respectful in ways that the other person understands as respect. One source said the opposite of empathy and emotional intelligence is hard-heartedness, mercilessness, pitilessness, ruthlessness, uncharitableness, disdain, hatred, indifference, disagreement, discord, and disunity. The opposite of having emotional intelligence, seeing things from the other side. In the New Testament letter of James chapter 3, verses 17 and 18, it says, "But the wisdom that comes from heaven," the wisdom from God, "the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere, peacemakers who sow in peace raise a harvest of righteousness." How much wisdom from heaven have we seen or heard in the last few years in our conversations, in our online comments? Wisdom puts knowledge and intelligence and empathy together to make an effective case or argument for your beloved causes. And we're trying to persuade others, other human beings made in God's image who should be respected as such too. Proverbs 9:10 says of wisdom that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. So Esther shows us how to take a stand with wisdom, but also with winsomeness. Winsomeness is making your case or argument in an attractive way, an enduring way, and a charming way to others. You present your idea in a gracious way, maybe even with joy, definitely with faith, maybe with a sense of humor. Winsomeness is shown in the New Testament book of Colossians 4:6 that says, "Let your conversation always be filled with grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone." Colossians 4:6, "Let your conversations always be filled with grace, seasoned with salt, so that you will know how to answer everyone." How to answer everyone? Having an answer is only part of the journey, right? And that's important too. You need to have an answer. But how you answer is also vitally important. Knowing how to answer requires wisdom and winsomeness. Ultimately, we want to please God with our words and actions, even when we argue for our cause or push our issue or defend the truth and tradition. We want to please God and glorify God in the way that we do these things, in our speeches, in our online comments. So let's see how Esther shows wisdom and winsomeness in her life and death decision and actions here. The wisdom and winsomeness of Esther. Now, for people today, Esther might be a very frustrating character. Very frustrating. She doesn't come in with guns blazing, maybe more of the American way, demanding her rights, pushing her weight around as queen. She doesn't demand that the king change that scheduled order to kill all of the Jews in a single day. You'll remember that's what Haman enacted with the king's authority, with his own signet ring. No, she painfully, slowly, and strategically gets King Xerxes and Haman, two most powerful men of the kingdom, right where she wants them. She doesn't want to shout down the opposition or be heard on a megaphone level or just get attention any way that she can. All press, all attention is not necessarily good press or good attention. No, she wants to be effective. She wants to be effective in her effort to change the king's mind and to persuade him. This is her life and the life of her people who are at stake. And this may be her last act as queen, or even of her own life, even. Her every move seems to be carefully thought out here, and that's important. It must be. She's been fasting from food and water for 3 days, if you remember, at the end of chapter 4, with the other Jews in the capital city, in Susa, praying to God, seeking wisdom from God and how she will approach the king, or even if she will approach the king. So this is where we pick it up in chapter 5. Beginning on the third day of the fast from food and water. It's the third day of fasting from food and water, but it seems like this is all that Esther can think about is food and drink, as she plans not just one banquet, but two banquets. And even her physical approach in verse 1 is very strategic. Don't miss the details there in verse 1. Verses 1 and 2 go like this. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the palace, in front of the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the hall, facing the entrance. You see, a picture is being painted here for us. Verse 2, when he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her and held out the gold scepter that was in his hand. So Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. Do you think Esther knew what she was doing? That the king would be sitting on his throne and what the line of sight might be. She stood in the inner court facing the king's hall in sight of the throne wearing her royal robes. Now first, she strategically spent time in prayer and fasting, seeking the Lord's guidance. Then she strategically stood still. She strategically waited. There's no rushing here, no barging into the king's chambers, no frantic emotional appeal. She waited there in the inner court, and then the king actually invited her in. Did you notice that? The king invited her in. Is that what she was waiting for? The king's sight, eyes to catch hers? Did she want the king to think that he's the one that actually had the idea to speak to her? Do you think she knows what she's doing? As a sign of respect and decorum, of course, she comes in, she touches the tip of the scepter, and this all sounds like good news to us, right? The king is pleased with Esther. He allows her into his presence without being invited, which we know is a huge deal, right? Esther is already afraid of what might happen if she came uninvited before the king, that she might be killed. There's actually a relief that was discovered from archaeologists that shows the Persian king on his throne with a scepter in his hand, and right behind him is a soldier with an axe, this large axe, you know, ready to kill somebody. Everyone should have a sigh of relief at this point. Whew. Esther made it in. She's before the king, and it says he's pleased with her. Well, then the king asks her, what is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be given you. He didn't really mean half the kingdom. The king wouldn't give away half the kingdom to Esther. It was just a way of saying, I'm feeling generous today. I'm feeling generous today. He's in a good mood. And this is where we are cheering Esther on in our heads, aren't we? Go ahead, Esther, now's the time. Push your cause. Tell of your plight and the plight of your people. Spell out the injustices to him. Now's the time. He's in a good and generous mood. Do it. But instead, Esther does what? Invites him to a banquet, a dinner party. What? What are you doing, Esther? Why the delay? She says in verse 4, let the king, together with Haman, come today to the banquet I have prepared for him. Now maybe you're wondering why I'm saying that way, together with Haman. Well, in the original Hebrew, it's a little more obvious here where it says, let the king come, and Haman, today to the banquet I have prepared for him. And him is that singular referring to the king. Do you think Esther knows how to flatter a king? Do you think Esther knows how to write or make an invitation that makes the king sound like he is the most important person on that list, the A-list of guests, and to make Haman seem like an, oh, by the way, sort of guest? I think she knows how to write invitations. She's strategically patient, not to mention the common saying that the best way to a man's heart is through his stomach, right? Why a dinner party? Why the delay, though? Well, Haman's not there, right, when Esther invites them both to the banquet. What if she came right out with her concern about Haman there and then? Well, there'd have to be another meeting with Haman, and it may just be the king and Haman having this meeting. Well, if they were both together, there would be less chance for Haman to hem and haw and to conjure up a lie about what happened, and there would be no wiggle room in some other meeting without Esther present, you know, just between us guys. No, Esther wants Haman right there. Catch him off guard. You think she knew what she was doing? Esther is careful and a brilliant strategist. Maybe you haven't thought about Esther that way. You've probably thought of her courage and faith that allowed her to make that daring choice in the moment of decision to go to bat for her people. But she's also this brilliant strategist here, because it's not just being willing to take a stand that's important, but how you take that stand that's vitally important. And having emotional, intelligent discernment to see beyond the facts, to see how the other side views things and experiences things, will be vital for an effective approach, an effective presentation, as it is in any kind of negotiation, even if you're a kid negotiating with your parents trying to get an Xbox, right? You want to see things from your parents' point of view to help you make an effective case for that Xbox. So King Xerxes and Haman dinner, they're drinking wine, it says. They're probably mellow and comfortable, and the king asks her again what she wants, and he says, he's still saying, I'm feeling generous today, up to half the kingdom. So Esther's got them right where she wants them. Now's the time. This must be the such a time as this moment. We cheer her on. And what does she do? She invites them to yet another dinner party. What? Can you believe it? Another banquet? What is she doing? Was Esther getting cold feet? Why another banquet? I'm baffled by the banquets here. Well, next we can see some of the results of the patience of Esther. You'll have to stay tuned for the rest of the sermon series to see the other results. I'll try not to give too much away. But beginning in verse 9, we have a happy Haman. We have a happy Haman who feels excited to be on the same level as king and queen. At least that's how he probably sees it. It says, Haman went out that day, verse 9, happy and in high spirits. That is until he saw that Mordecai, right, who showed him no respect as usual. And it says Haman was filled with rage against Mordecai. His mood changed that quickly. And then Haman goes home and throws a little party of his own. We might call it a pity party, right? He brags about all of his achievements and honors, including being the only one Queen Esther has invited to the banquet with the king. But according to Haman, all of that's for naught. All of that's nothing because of Mordecai, who doesn't do what he wants him to do. He doesn't have total control over everybody. There's this one person in the kingdom who doesn't stroke his ego the way he wants, and that's just driving him mad. Every day he sees the king at the king's gate, or he sees Mordecai at the king's gate, and every day there's that one guy who doesn't salute him. Now, maybe you thought this way too, but it seems to me there would be certain levels of discipline that could have been imposed on Mordecai for his lack of respect. Death by impalement on a pole in public doesn't seem to be that natural first level of discipline. But that's his wife Zeresh and friends' idea. They say to him in verse 14, have a pole set up, reaching to a height of 50 cubits, and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai impaled on it. Then go with the king to the banquet and enjoy yourself. Because there's nothing like a good impalement to whet one's appetite, right? You see, the strange thing here is that Haman will only have to wait less than a year for all the Jews to be killed, including Mordecai. But his own ego apparently can't wait that long. A quick note about impalement here in our translation. Many of you who know Esther from birth and have been studying it and going to Bible studies a lot, go through the book of Esther, you may be wondering where the gallows have gone. Where the gallows have gone. For the Hebrew word for gallows, it simply means wood or a piece of wood. And as a means of execution, wood being built or constructed makes us, especially in the West, think about gallows to kill or hang someone on. But not so in Persia. They were fond of using wood to impale someone on, and not just to kill them, but to publicly disgrace them, and of course use it as a gruesome execution and public scene in order to try to keep others from doing whatever that person did. So yes, it's like one, like a Roman cross of Jesus' day, a very gruesome public execution. So instead of gallows, we have this huge pole, some 75 feet high, six-story building high, the height of the Pentagon, Haman had built in order to kill Mordecai, to hang Mordecai on it, says in verse 14. It's interesting that he builds it, and then he was planning to ask permission later, right? That's how arrogant he is. That's how confident he is that he's pulling the king's strings. They could just build this, and yeah, he'll get the final approval in the morning, and then we'll have an impalement, and then we'll have lunch, right? So Haman's ego, pride, and the fact that he's easily offended causes his judgment to be clouded, because this strategic patience of Esther has really given Haman more time to sharpen the pole of his own implement of impalement. He lacks wisdom and discernment. He's certainly not winsome. Like the king allowed the nobles to pull his strings, Haman allows his own wife and friends to pull his strings, tell him what he wants to hear. He has his own yes men too. Esther, though, is strategically patient in her approach. Now, some would say that Esther was just lucky through all of this. She was just lucky through all of this, that things just happened to fall into place, or that the Jews were just lucky. Well, as I've mentioned before, God's providence plays a huge role in the Esther story. How lucky were the Jews that Esther was so attractive, that she was chosen over many others by the king, that Mordecai happened to overhear an assassination plot, that this report by Mordecai was recorded in the official records, that the king couldn't sleep one night and asked that records be read to him so he could fall asleep, and the particular records that were read to him were about Mordecai, and that the king actually did something about that. Lucky? I don't think so. God has been at work in every step of the way, just like he's at work in every step of our life too, no matter what we're going through. And if it seems bad or we're experiencing injustices, God's providence is still at work. God is still at work. Now, there are many good and godly issues to take a stand for in today's broken world. We're called to take a stand for the gospel in a world and a nation that whose tolerance has been very low for religious belief. But being willing to take a stand is just the first step, and that's important. We have to be willing to take a stand. But how we take that stand will be very important. Maybe we need to spend some time in prayer and fasting as we discern how to take that stand in our particular environments, whether it's in our schools, our university, our city, our nation, using wisdom and winsomeness along with the strategic patience of Esther, will take us a long way in taking our stand today. effectively taking our stand today. The scepter of God's love and grace has been extended through the cross of Christ to us. It's there for us to reach out to receive the mercy, the grace, and the forgiveness of the King of the universe. He gives us a new identity in Christ, filling us with the fruit of the Spirit, which includes patience, self-control, so that we might wisely and winsomely share the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ in our lost and broken world. Praise be to God for that. Would you join me in prayer? God, we thank you for choosing us and calling us to be your people in such a time as this. Lord, what are we waiting for? You have given us what we need, your presence. You make us bold. You make us courageous. You make us wise as we revere you and your holy word. Teach us how to be wise and winsome as we present the gospel to others. And as we stand up for the weak and the voiceless ones among us, as we advocate for the poor, the helpless, and the vulnerable. And as we do, may others be drawn to the light of Jesus, who with the Father and the Holy Spirit is one God now and forevermore. Amen.